Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$500 million is a lot of money. Multiply it by four, and what you might have is the end of the liquidity crunch. Four big Wall Street banks announced today they've been heavy borrowers from the Federal Reserve. That's exactly what the Fed wanted to happen when it cut interest rates last Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 22nd of August today. It's a Wednesday, and it's good to have you with us. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Wachovia went public with their borrowing habits today, $500 million apiece from the discount window at the Federal Reserve. That's the interest rate the Fed cut Friday morning as a way to get cash flowing again on Wall Street. And in the short term, at least, it seems to have worked. There was a third straight day of relative calm in the stock markets. But there are still some unsettling noises coming from the housing and mortgage industries. Today, Accredited Home Lenders and Lehman Brothers became the latest to announce they're shutting down their subprime mortgage businesses and making deep cuts in their workforces. Added up, and in just the past few weeks, tens of thousands of people in the lending business have lost their jobs. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
In relative terms, experts say the job losses are neither surprising nor alarming. It's the swiftness of this reversal of fortunes that employment consultant John Challenger finds so stunning.
Many of these mortgage companies have just stopped on a dime. They've come to a screeching halt. They've told their employees, don't take any calls, don't write any more loans. We can't go forward with these operations.
Challenger says that means thousands of call center workers, data processors, and their supervisors are sitting idle. He says it's fortunate the damage is spread out across the country and not hitting any particular geographic area. That's little consolation, though, for some 21,000 mortgage industry workers who Challenger figures have been fired since the start of August. Chicago-based investment manager Marshall Front expects the long list of belly-up lenders to keep growing, but not become so big that it'll cause serious trouble.
We're in a period of consolidation. That's not going to be pleasant. Will it bring our economic expansion to a halt and cause a recession? No.
But there have been some contagious effects. At Moody'sEconomy.com, senior economist Zoltan Pozsar says it's been hitting related businesses from landscaping and interior decorating to real estate appraisers.
We have created 1.3 million housing-related jobs between 2003 and 2005. Since then, we have lost 260,000. And I think when all this is said and done, about half of the jobs that were created in housing-related industries during the housing boom will be lost.
Painful though that may be, Pozsar says this limited contraction could actually be beneficial overall. He says it should moderate consumer spending and help keep a lid on inflation. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So, what do we have? Generally speaking, the mortgage industry can't come up with cash, and mortgage companies are laying people off, or worse, going bankrupt. And yet, investors are smiling on one small slice of the mortgage market, the good old-fashioned thrift. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports.
One of the main ways mortgage lenders get money to issue home loans is through the secondary market. They sell your mortgages to investors and use the cash to issue new loans. Bob Davis is with America's Community Bankers. It represents the savings and loan or thrift industry. He says the current market turmoil is good news for thrifts.
The problem in the market today exists because the institutional investor market, the secondary market, is frozen up for certain types of loans. That's not the case for institutions that hold the loans and fund them with deposits. That is a traditional business that savings associations or savings and loans have engaged in.
Thrifts still have easy access to money because people are still depositing into savings and checking accounts. Thrifts currently make about 25% of all residential mortgages. Now that big mortgage lenders are having problems, Davis predicts SNL's market share will grow. Douglas Hughes is president of BankNewsletter.com, which tracks the thrift industry. He says investors piled into SNL stocks when they realize those lenders have hardly any exposure to subprime.
Thrifts especially made new lows and new highs within a 48-hour period for the year. Never seen something like that in my life.
Remember the SNL crisis in the 80s? Investors who do might find it ironic that thrifts are a safe haven now. But homebuyers shouldn't expect an easy ride from thrifts. They may be lending, but experts say many thrifts' underwriting standards are high, and their rates may be going up, too. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
One more thing before we get off the topic of interest rates. Only 17 trading days left until the next Fed meeting on September the 18th. Investors were in a buying mood from the word go this morning. All three of the major indices traded a good deal higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This one escaped our notice somehow, although we probably should have been looking for it. Playboy magazine has decided to get in on the social networking business. Playboy U, it's called. Open to college students only. No nudity, thank you, but some very adult content all the same. The company's hoping to steer clear of the problems other networking sites have had. Minors getting access they shouldn't get and predators knowing it. States are trying to force sites like MySpace and Facebook to come up with ways to verify the ages of their members and ways to figure out who's a kid and who's a parent. We've called Victoria Barrett at Forbes magazine to figure out what that might do to bottom lines. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Will these parental controls be expensive for Facebook and MySpace and the other networking sites?
Well, expense is almost the secondary issue. The real issue is how do we do this in any sort of effective way? If you really want to introduce identity, you have to somehow bridge the gap between the computer and the person who's using it. And that is incredibly difficult. And the expense for this to be done really thoroughly would be very high, because essentially you'd have to have some kind of biometric information, a finger scan, an iris scan. Not only do I think that's not very feasible, but it would be very expensive.
Surely, though, some engineer up there where you are in Silicon Valley, if we threw enough money at them, would be able to plug something in that would make business sense for Rupert Murdoch and MySpace and all the others.
Well, it depends if there's a legal action where they're forced to do this, right? The problem with the web, there's really no such thing as identity on the web. We don't know who people are. Your credit card can be a form of identity, but kids under 18 don't typically have credit cards. Again, you could create some sort of hardware system that does that, but it's not really in Rupert Murdoch's interest to do so unless he's forced to by the government.
Mm-hmm. And of course, MySpace is not about to make it a requirement of admission that you pay $80 for a biometric scanner to have next to your computer, right?
I think your instincts are right on that one, yes.
Yeah. You know, so not to keep picking on MySpace, but what the heck. Rupert Murdoch spent $500-something million to buy MySpace. Do you think a little part of him now is saying maybe this is more trouble than it's worth?
The legal troubles are certainly a pain, but I have heard that MySpace is on track to do $1 billion in revenues this year and is profitable. So I have a feeling he's still pretty good on this deal.
Do you think advertisers are worried at all about their involvement with social networking sites?
There's a potential for a backlash, right? When MySpace announced that they had found 29,000 registered sex offenders on the site, I thought, gee, if I was a Procter & Gamble, would that make me a little bit leery? If this becomes an even bigger story, there is a potential that advertisers would get a little bit nervous.
Victoria Barrett's an associate editor at Forbes magazine up in Silicon Valley. Victoria, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
The president made a speech to the veterans of foreign wars today where he laid out his case for continued involvement in Iraq. The speech was the opening volley in a White House campaign to build support for keeping American troops there. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the president's going to have some well-financed allies backing him up.
Freedom's Watch, a nonprofit group formed just 2 weeks ago, plans to spend $15 million in the next month airing ads like this one featuring a veteran who echoes Bush's arguments for staying in Iraq.
They attacked us, and they will again. They won't stop in Iraq.
Freedom Watch's president, Brad Blakely, says he'll spend millions targeting individual members of Congress and airing ads nationally. But for now, he's keeping the details of his strategy under wraps.
Because this is a campaign, I have not locked in because I have to see where the best bang for our buck is.
This may be a campaign, but Blakely's group doesn't have to follow campaign finance laws. Freedom's Watch was able to raise millions almost instantly because it's organized as a 501c4, a special kind of tax-exempt nonprofit. Groups like this can legally accept huge donations, and they never, ever have to disclose the names of their donors. For those looking for an end run around campaign finance restrictions,
501c4s are perfect.
Fran Hill is a law professor at the University of Miami.
There is no limit on the contribution of any one source, individual or corporate.
Blakely's group is voluntarily making some of its donors' names public, but not all of them. Are you going to make amounts available?
No, we're not releasing any amounts of any individual because we don't have to.
Anti-war groups don't have to disclose their donors either. The result? More negative ads. And the American public may never find out who's paying for them. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
One definition of success as a recording artist is to become what's called a crossover hit. Usually that's a singer moving from a smaller niche to a much wider audience. Here in the U.S., that used to mean Spanish-speaking singers breaking into English-language charts. Increasingly, though, it means English-speaking artists delivering their lyrics en español. Ambar Espinoza reports.
The R&B artist Beyoncé is taking the lead at tapping into the Spanish-language market. The singer doesn't speak Spanish, but she re-released her most recent album with 6 Spanish tracks. Her efforts are paying off. She's the first non-Latina to make the list of 50 most beautiful people in People magazine in Español. And she's gotten invitations to appear on influential Spanish-language radio stations like K-Love in Los Angeles.
Beyoncé, why Spanish? Why you want to record in Spanish?
Porque quisiste grabar en español, Beyoncé.
Well, I'm from Houston, Texas.
Soy de Houston, Texas.
I grew up around a lot of people that spoke Spanish.
Y crecí, bueno, alrededor.
In another savvy marketing ploy, Beyoncé has teamed up with Latin American megastars like Shakira, Voltio, and here, with Mexican singing sensation Alejandro Fernandez to perform the theme song for a very popular Latin soap opera. The man who translated Beyoncé's songs is award-winning producer and songwriter Rudy Perez. He can't speak highly enough of the effect her marketing strategies are having. He points to one Spanish version of her hit song, Irreplaceable. The song was remixed with a regional Mexican beat.
By having done that, we were bumped up 34% in the radio airplay in 1 week, which turned out to be probably one of the most successful singles in the history of recorded pop music.
Perez says a key reason American labels and artists need to break into the Latino market is this. Overall music sales in the U.S. are slumping. Latin music sales are climbing, about 5% a year. And edgy young artists like Beyoncé aren't the only ones switching to Spanish. It's also performers like Family Music singer Dan Zanes.
Verde luz de monte y mar.
In a studio in Manhattan, he performs one of the tracks on his first Spanish-only album, scheduled for release next year. The album is a collection of songs from Latin America and the Caribbean, and he sings them along with local Latino musicians in New York. Zane says it's his way of celebrating the cultural vitality immigration has brought to the U.S.
The biggest thing I could do is to begin to cross over the language, you know, what once felt like a barrier, but now it just feels like a wonderful opportunity.
Zanes is still working on being fully bilingual, so he can eventually write his own Spanish songs. He says he wants his music to sound like his New York neighborhood, so numbers in Spanish have always been a part of his albums and concerts. It's not just artists we're evolving, it's the Latino market itself. Jeff Valdez is a television producer and marketing expert. He says Latinos' numbers and buying power are changing the very nature of the game.
The consuming is so large that it just can't be a niche anymore. It's really, I consider it the new general market.
More and more artists in every format, from mainstream pop to hip-hop, are eager for a slice of the pie. Even the Country Music Association plans to launch a marketing campaign in 2008 to attract Latino listeners. In Los Angeles, I'm Ámbar Espinosa for Marketplace.
Coming up, meeting the skeletons in a famous wine family's cellar.
When Peter goes back to Mama Mondavi, she says, "What did you do to my babe?" and banished Robert from the family company.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks tracked higher on Wall Street again today, bolstered by a number of buyout announcements. The Dow Industrials gained 1.1%, 145 points, to close at 13,236. The Nasdaq rose 1.25%, 31 points, 2,552 was the number. The S&P 500 hiked up 1.1%, 16 points, to 1,464. NYMEX was more than 6% higher on news the Commodities Exchange is in talks about a possible merger. TD Ameritrade tracked up nearly 5% today on chatter about a possible deal with E-Trade. E-Trade stock dropped more than 2% on that same news. That's kind of the way it works with a merger. Overseas, Britain's FTSE 100 rose 1.8%. The German DAX rose 1%. Bonds traded off just a bit today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. AngiesList.com. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the American Medical Association launches a three-year campaign to get America's uninsured covered. The National Association of Counties reviews results of a new survey of methamphetamine abuse across counties and its effect on communities. And it's the United Nations International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. MGM Mirage rolled the dice today on a new business partner. It's Dubai, as in part of the UAE. The government-owned holding company Dubai World is going to take a minority slice of the hotel and gaming enterprise. $5 billion cash on the barrelhead was the sticker price. Dubai World's been on a buying spree of late. One of its subsidiaries dropped almost $1 billion a couple of weeks ago on luxury retailer Barney's. And earlier this summer, it bought a little boat called the QE2. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more.
What's going on here is actually very simple. Dubai is sitting on a lot of money, and Milton Pedraza of the research firm The Luxury Institute says
they need to diversify their cash clearly out of oil.
Dubai is doing that by snapping up brands associated with wealth and luxury, the kinds of brands only the richest can enjoy. Pedraza says there's a reason for that.
Dubai is trying to convert itself as an entity, as a country, and as a global investor into a luxury brand itself.
Enter MGM Mirage. That company's been working to diversify its own brand, play down the gambling, and build up hotel and entertainment complexes like its enormous project on the Las Vegas Strip called City Center. The company also wants to get its mitts on a more international audience. Terry Lanny is chief executive officer of MGM Mirage. He says the deal with Dubai will help him do that.
The number of Russian oligarchs and the number of wealthy Indians coming into Abu Dhabi and Dubai and throughout the whole Emirates is something that's very, very important to us.
Lanny says the fact that Dubai comes with cash and not some complicated private equity deal is a bonus, too. No worries about a credit crunch here.
They don't have to worry about banks. They own banks.
And there's a lot more cash in Dubai's coffers waiting to be spent. It has said it'll spend at least $13 billion on acquisitions this year. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Staying with the international theme here, there was another recall of Chinese imports today. The Consumer Product Safety Commission made the announcement. It includes 250,000 SpongeBob SquarePants address books and journals. Too much lead paint on their spiral bindings, it seems. There has been some talk that all the problems China's having with manufacturing can be traced to its get-rich-quick economic system. But commentator Robert Reich says our brand of free market isn't squeaky clean either.
20 years ago, we divided the world's economic systems into two camps. On one side were communist government-run economies. On the other side, capitalist free market economies. Now Chinese free market capitalists are going gangbusters. And China's problem isn't too much government intrusion into its economy. It's too little. Or at least too little of the right kind. Chinese toy makers have used lead paint. Some Chinese pet food producers have employed toxic chemicals. And makers of counterfeit toothpaste in China have used other toxins. A basic free market principle is that when consumers cannot differentiate between risky products and good products, they withdraw from the market, which is what's happening to China's consumer exports. So China has to rein in its rip-roaring free market capitalists with regulations that better ensure safe products. The American financial market is facing much the same challenge. When it became apparent that many subprime mortgage loans were far riskier than assumed and were packaged with other loans, investors began withdrawing from all sorts of financial instruments because they couldn't figure out how much risk they had taken on. So now we have to rein in our rip-roaring financial capitalists with regulations that clarify risk by, for example, requiring hedge funds to disclose more, and credit rating agencies to do better. The lesson on both sides of the Pacific is that free market capitalism and government intervention are not on opposite sides of a great divide. Free markets need governments to police them so buyers can be confident about what they're buying. If governments fail in this basic job, buyers will be scared off, and this will bring down even responsible sellers. The practical question, then, in China and America isn't whether you're in favor of free markets or government regulation. It's what kind of regulation is needed to make markets work.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Once upon a time, he was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. Drop us a line when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Think of the last bottle of wine you had. Chances are it came from California. The Golden State produces 90% of American wine, and one man gets a lot of credit for that and for bringing California to prominence in the global wine industry. Robert Mondavi spent his life building up California's wineries, but his business didn't always see healthy returns. Julia Flynn Seiler has written a new biography of Mondavi. Julia, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We have some wine here in the studio. Why don't you tell us what we're going to taste and why sort of this one is a good example of what you'll find in the supermarket.
Okay. This is a Robert Mondavi Private Selection Cabernet Sauvignon. The label says it's from California. And all you see in this label is the tower, the famous Oakville Tower from the Robert Mondavi Winery, sort of peeking through the clouds. You'll find this bottle at supermarkets for about $10. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the very finest brands that were the embodiment of Robert Mondavi quality have the same elements on their label. They also have Robert Mondavi. They also have the tower. People got confused. And that's why there have been at least 5 Harvard Business School case studies about what happened at the Robert Mondavi Corporation.
Pour me a splash.
Okay.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
So, cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, so you know, that's funny. This is radio, so nobody can see that. But she gave it a thumbs down. Didn't much like it.
Didn't like it. Sorry about that.
How come?
It tastes thin to me.
All right, fair enough. But let's talk about the company for a second. What was the debate over whether to sell sort of high-minded, snobby wines or stuff that's going to sell to the average consumer?
Robert Mondavi and his brother Peter began the business with their father Cesare back in the 30s. And at that point, they were producing tank wines. In the early 60s, they started improving the quality of these wines. And a huge family rift developed. In fact, they came to blows at one point.
Actual blows.
Actual blows. One of the most famous fist fights in the wine industry.
Not very wine-like, though. You wouldn't
know. No. There was a family gathering in late 1965. By one account, these two brothers ended up rolling around in the dust. Robert throttles Peter when Peter goes back to Mama Mondavi. She says, "What did you do to my babe?" and banished Robert from the family company.
So he goes about his business through the late 60s and early 70s, building this winery. And then in the late 70s, starts something called Opus One, a bottle of which, sadly, we cannot afford to bring into the studio.
That was a watershed moment in the American wine industry. It was almost a coming of age for American wine. The noble Rothschild family of France had chosen Robert Mondavi, an immigrant son, to partner with. And that was the first joint venture between a French Grand Cru producer and an American winemaker.
The company, though, suffers a great deal. What happened?
I think what happened was they tried to do too many things at once. And there was great pressure on a quarterly basis to increase sales and profits. And that's very hard in the wine business.
There is another bottle over there. I think it's a Fumé Blanc. Pour us that one, and let's see how that one goes. Just for the record, we're only taking tiny sips, tiny little sips. Oh, see, now that's so much better than that first one we tried.
This is actually really good. Napa Valley. This is from probably the most famous vineyard in America called Tokalon, which is Greek for most beautiful. And still, when you visit the Robert Mondavi Winery, you understand what it was that was magical back then.
The book by Julia Flynn Seiler is called The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. Julia, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Guy.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, for those who thought all that free browsing of videos on YouTube was too good to last, go straight to the head of the class. As of today, you can expect to see ads on some of those videos. And forget about fast-forwarding through them. The ads won't start until about 15 seconds into whatever clip you're watching. And then they're going to appear sort of translucently over the top of the video. With about 100 million visitors a day, YouTube was the next logical step for Google to try to get some revenue out of. The search engine company bought YouTube last fall for more than $1.5 billion. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 145 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ gained 31 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 jumped 16 points, also 1.1% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time on the program, an enterprising CEO makes his car rental customers a promise.
We are not going to be flipped, be levered up, have higher costs, and have to raise rates.
Get it? Enterprise, CEO, car rental. It's another conversation from the corner office. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.